Chapter 32 The Play. It was only after the vision of that great building hanging, then vanishing above the city, that I knew I had come to love Dorcas. We walked down the road, for we had found a new road just over the top of the hill, into darkness. And because our thoughts were entirely of what we had seen, our spirits embraced without hindrance, each passing through those few seconds of vision, as if through a door never previously opened and never to be opened again. I do not know just where it was we walked. I recall a winding road down the hillside, an arched bridge at the bottom, and another road bordered for a league or so by a vagabond wooden fence. Wherever it was we went, I know we talked about ourselves not at all, but only of what we had seen and what its meaning might be. And I know that at the beginning of that walk, I looked on Dorcas as no more than a chance-met companion, however desirable, however to be pitied. And at the end of it, I loved Dorcas in a way that I have never loved another human being. I did not love her because I had come to love Thecla less. Rather, by loving Dorcas, I loved Thecla more, because Dorcas was another self, as Thecla was yet to become in a fashion, as terrible as the other was beautiful. And if I loved Thecla, Dorcas loved her also. "Do you think," she asked, "that anyone saw it but us?" I had not considered that. But I said that although the suspension of the building had endured for only a moment, yet it had taken place above the greatest of cities, and that if millions and tens of millions had failed to see it, yet hundreds must still have seen. "Isn't it possible it was only a vision meant only for us?" "I have never had a vision, Dorcas. And I don't know whether I've had any or not. When I try to recall the time before I helped you out of the water, I can only remember being in the water myself. Everything before that is like a vision shattered to pieces. Only small bright bits. A thimble I saw laid on velvet once. And the sound of a small dog barking outside a door. Nothing like this. Nothing like what we've seen." What she said made me remember the note, which I had been searching for when my fingers touched the claw, and that in turn suggested the brown book, which lay in the pleat of my saber tash next to it. I asked Dorcas if she would not like to see the book that had once been Thecla's, when we found a place to stop.
"Yes," she said. "When we are seated by a fire again, as we were for a moment at that inn.
Finding that relic, which of course I will have to return before we can leave the city. And what we have been saying, too, remind me of something I read there once. Do you know of the key to the universe?" Dorcas laughed softly.
"No, Severian. I, who scarcely know my name, do not know anything about the key to the universe."
I didn't say that as well as I should have. What I meant was, are you familiar with the idea that the universe has a secret key? A sentence or a phrase, some say even a single word that can be wrung from the lips of a certain statue or read in the firmament, or that an anchorite on a world across the seas teaches his disciples?
"Babies know it," Dorcas said. "They know it before they learn to speak, but by the time they're old enough to talk, they have forgotten most of it. At least someone told me that once."
"That's what I mean, something like that. The Brown Book is a collection of the myths of the past, and it has a section listing all the keys of the universe, all the things people have said were the secret
after they had talked to mystagogues on far worlds, or studied the Popol Vuh of the magicians, or fasted in the trunks of holy trees. Thekla and I used to read them and talk about them, and one of them was that everything, whatever happens, has three meanings. The first is its practical meaning, what the book calls the thing the plowman sees. The cow has taken a mouthful of grass, and it is real grass, and a real cow. That meaning is as important and as true as either of the others. The second is the reflection of the world about it. Every object is in contact with all others, and thus the wise can learn of the others by observing the first. That might be called the soothsayer's meaning, because it is the one such people use when they prophesy a fortunate meeting from the tracks of serpents or confirm the outcome of a love affair by putting the elector of one suit atop the patroness of another.
And the third meaning? Dorcas asked.
The third is the transubstantial meaning. Since all objects have their ultimate origin in the Pan-Creator, and all were set in motion by him, so all must express his will, which is the higher reality.
You're saying that what we saw was a sign?
I shook my head.
The book is saying that everything is a sign.
The post of that fence is a sign, and so is the way the tree leans across it. Some signs may betray the third meaning more readily than others. For perhaps 100 paces, we were both silent. Then Dorcas said,
"It seems to me that if what the Chatelaine Thekla's book says is true, then people have everything backward. We saw a great structure leap into the air and fall to nothing, didn't we?"
"I only saw it suspended over the city. Did it leap?" Dorcas nodded.
I could see the glimmer of her pale hair in the moonlight. "It seems to me that what you call the third meaning is very clear, but the second meaning is harder to find, and the first, which ought to be the easiest, is impossible." I was about to say I understood her, at least about the first meaning, when I heard from some distance off a rumbling roar that might have been a long roll of thunder. Dorcas exclaimed, "What's that?" and took my hand in her own small warm one, which I found very pleasant.
"I don't know, but I think it came from the copse up ahead."
She nodded. "Now I hear voices."
"Your hearing is better than mine, then." The rumbling sounded again, louder and more prolonged, and this time, perhaps only because we were a trifle nearer, I thought I saw the gleam of lights through the trunks of the grove of young beeches ahead of us.
"There,"
Dorcas said, and pointed in a direction somewhat to the north of the trees.
"That can't be a star. It's too low and too bright and moves too quickly.
It's a lantern, I think, on a wagon perhaps, or carried in someone's hand." The rumble came once more, and this time I knew it for what it was. The rolling of a drum. I could hear voices now myself, very faintly, and particularly one voice that sounded deeper than the drum and almost as loud. As we rounded the edge of the copse, we saw about 50 people gathered around a small platform. On it, between flaring torches, stood a giant who held a kettle drum beneath one arm like a tom-tom. A much smaller man, richly dressed, stood on his right, and on his left, nearly naked, the most sensuously beautiful woman I have ever seen.
"Everyone is here,"
the small man was saying loudly and very rapidly.
"Everyone is here. What would you have? Love and beauty?"
He pointed to the woman.
"Strength? Courage?"
He waved the stick he carried toward the giant.
"Deception. Mystery."
He tapped his own chest.
"Vice?"
He pointed toward the giant again.
And look here.
See who's just come. It's our old enemy Death, who always comes sooner or later.
With this he pointed to me, and every face in the audience turned to stare. It was Dr. Talos and Baldanders. Their presence seemed inevitable as soon as I had recognized them. So far as I knew, I had never seen the woman.
Death! Dr. Talos said. Death has come. I doubted you these past 2 days, old friend. I ought to have known better.
I expected the audience to laugh at this grim humor, but they did not. A few muttered to themselves, and a crone spat into her palm and pointed 2 fingers toward the ground.
And who is it he has brought with him?
Dr. Talos leaned forward to peer at Dorcas in the torchlight.
Innocence, I believe it is. Yes, it's innocence.
Now everyone is here. The show will begin in a moment or two. Not for the faint of heart.
You have never seen anything like it, anything at all.
Everyone is here now.
The beautiful woman was gone. And such was the magnetism of the doctor's voice that I had not noticed when she left. If I were to describe Dr. Talos's play now, as it appeared to me, a participant, the result could only be confusion. When I describe it as it appeared to the audience, as I intend to do at a more appropriate point in this account, I will not perhaps be believed. In a drama with a cast of 5, of whom 2 on the first night had not learned their parts, armies marched, orchestras played, snow fell, and earth trembled. Dr. Talos demanded much from the imagination with narration. Simple yet clever machinery, shadows cast upon screens, holographic projectors, recorded noises, reflecting backdrops, and every other conceivable sleight. And on the whole, he succeeded admirably, as evidenced by the sobs, shouts, and sighs that floated toward us from time to time out of the dark. Triumphing in all this, he yet failed. For his desire was to communicate, to tell a great tale that had being only in his mind and could not be reduced to common words. But no one who ever witnessed a performance, and still less we who moved across his stage and spoke at his bidding, ever left it, I think, with any clear understanding of what that tale was. It could only, Dr. Talos said, be expressed in the ringing of bells and the thunder of explosions, and sometimes by the postures of ritual. Yet as it proved in the end, it could not be expressed even by these. There was a scene in which Dr. Talos fought Baldanders until the blood ran down both their faces. There was another in which Baldanders searched for a terrified Jolenta, that was the name of the most beautiful woman in the world, in a room of an underground palace, and at last seated himself on the chest where she lay hidden. In the final part, I held the center of the stage, presiding over a chamber of inquiry, in which Baldanders, Dr. Talos, Jolenta, and Dorcas were bound in various apparatuses. As the audience watched, I inflicted the most bizarre and ineffective, had they been real, torments on each in turn. In this scene, I could not help but notice how strangely the audience began to murmur while I was preparing, as it seemed, to wrench Dorcas's legs from their sockets. Though I was unaware of it, they had been permitted to see that Baldanders was freeing himself. Several women screamed when his chain clattered to the stage. I looked covertly toward Dr. Talos for directions, but he was already springing toward the audience, having freed himself with far less effort.
Tableau, he called. Tableau, everyone.
I froze in position, having learned that was what was meant.
Gracious people, you have watched our little show with admirable attention. Now we ask a bit of your purse as well as your time. At the conclusion of the play, you will see what occurs now that the monster has freed himself at last.
Dr. Talos was holding out his tall hat to the audience, and I heard several coins clink into it. Unsatisfied, he leaped from the stage and began to move among the people.
Remember that once he is free, nothing stands between him and the consummation of his brutal desires. Remember that I, his tormentor, am bound now and at his mercy. Remember that you have never as yet learned,
thank you, sir,
the identity of the mysterious figure seen by the Contessa through the curtained windows.
Thank you.
That above the dungeon you see now, the weeping statue,
thank you,
still digs under the rowan tree. Come now.
You have been very generous with your time. We ask only that you will not be penurious with your money. A few truly have treated us well, but we will not perform for a few. Where are the shining azami that should have showered into my poor hat long ago from the rest of you?
The few shall not pay for the multitude. If you've no azamis, then orichalks. If you have none, surely there is no one here without an ease.
Eventually a sufficient sum was gathered, and Dr. Talos vaulted back into his place and deftly reaffixed the fastenings that seemed to hold him in an embrace of spikes. Baldanders roared and stretched forth his long arms as though to grasp me, allowing the audience to observe that a second chain, unnoticed previously, still constrained him.
See him,
Dr. Talos prompted me sotto voce.
Hold him off with one of the flambeaux.
I pretended to discover for the first time that Baldander's arms were free, and plucked one of the torches from its socket at the corner of the stage. At once both torches guttered. The flames, which had been of clear yellow above scarlet, now burned blue and pale green, spitting sparks and sputtering, doubling and tripling in size with a fearful hiss, only to sink at once as if on the point of going out. I thrust the one I had uprooted at Baldander's, shouting,
"No! No! Back! Back!"
prompted again by Dr. Talos. Baldander's responded by roaring more furiously than ever. He strained at the chain in a way that made the scenery wall to which he was bound creak and snap, and his mouth began, quite literally, to foam, a thick white liquid running from the corners of his lips to bedew his huge chin and fleck his rusty black clothes as though with snow. Someone in the audience screamed, and the chain broke, with a report like the snapping of a drover's whip. By this time, the giant's face was hideous in its madness, and I would no more have attempted to stand in his way than to stop an avalanche. But before I could move a step to escape him, he had wrested the torch from me and knocked me down with its iron shaft. I got my head up in time to see him jerk the other torch from its place and make for the audience with both. The shrieking of men drowned the shrilling of women. It sounded as if our guild were exercising 100 clients together. I pulled myself up and was about to seize Dorcas and dash for the cover of the copse when I saw Dr. Talos. He seemed filled with what I can only call malignant good humor. And though he was freeing himself from his fastenings, he was taking his time about it. Jolenta was setting herself free as well, and if there were any expression at all on that perfect face, it was one of relief.
"Very well,"
Dr. Talos exclaimed.
"Very well indeed. You may come back now, Baldanders."
Don't leave us in the dark.
To me. Did you enjoy your maiden experience of the boards, Master Torturer? For a beginner acting without rehearsal, you played nicely enough.
I managed to nod. Except when Baldanders knocked you down.
You must forgive him. He could see you didn't know enough to drop.
Come with me now.
Baldanders has his talents, but a fine eye for minutiae lost in grass isn't one of them. I have some lights backstage, and you in innocence shall help us pick up.
I did not understand what he meant, but in a few moments the torches were back in place, and we were hunting through the trampled area in front of the stage with dark lanterns.
It's a gambling proposition,
Dr. Talos explained.
And I confess to loving them. The money in the hat is a sure thing. By the close of the first act, I can predict to an aura chalk how much it will be. But the dropsies, they may be no more than two apples and a turnip, or as much as the imagination can encompass. We have found a baby pig. Delicious.
So Baldanders told me when he ate it.
We have found a baby. We have found a gold-headed stick, and I retain it. Antique brooches. Shoes. We frequently find shoes of all kinds. Just now I have found a woman's parasol.
He held it up.
This will be just the thing to keep the sun from our fair Jolenta when we go strolling tomorrow.
Jolenta straightened up as people do who are straining not to stoop. Above the waist, her creamy amplitude was such that her spine must have been curved backward to balance the weight.
If we're going to an inn tonight, I'd like to go now, she said. I'm very tired, Doctor.
I was exhausted myself.
An inn? Tonight?
A criminal waste of funds. Look at it this way, my dear. The nearest is a league away at the very least, and it would take Baldanders and me a watch to pack the scenery and properties, even with the help of this friendly angel of torment. By the time we reach the inn at that rate, the horizon would be under the sun, the cocks would be crowing, and, like as not, 1,000 fools would be rising, banging their doors and throwing their slops.
Baldanders grunted, I thought in confirmation, then struck with his boot as if at some venomous thing he had discovered in the grass. Dr. Talos threw wide his arms to embrace the universe.
While here, my dear, beneath stars that are the personal and cherished property of the Increate, we have all anyone could wish for the most salubrious rest. There's just chill enough in the air tonight to make sleepers grateful for the warmth of their coverings and the heat of the fire, and not a hint of rain. Here we will camp. Here we will break our fast in the morning, and from here we will walk renewed in the joyful hours when the day is young.
I said, you mentioned something about breakfast. Is there any food now? Dorcas and I are hungry.
Of course there is. I see Baldanders has just picked up a basket of yams.
Several members of our erstwhile audience must have been farm people, returning from a market, with whatever produce they had been unable to sell. Besides the yams, we had, eventually, a pair of squabs and several stalks of young sugarcane. There was not much bedding, but there was some, and Dr. Talos himself used none of it, saying he would sit up and watch the fire, and perhaps nap later, in the chair that had been the Autarch's throne and the Inquisitor's bench a short time before.